afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO. Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
The Catholic Church and the Other. Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
The smokers quiet, we now have a new pope.
Habemus Papam.
It is Jorge Mario Bergoglio.
He's a Jesuit, and he has taken the name Francis.
You have chosen wisely.
He spent all his life being close to people, especially the poor.
And when he began to speak.
Buonasera.
He won me over and won the whole crowd over.
You had me at hello.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
I thought Bergoglio was like a recipe or something.
He was very well known for his love for the poor.
He kind of looked at himself and shrugged and said, now what have I got myself into?
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
This is a very exciting moment for the Universal Church.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Nick Tom, here to introduce a very special edition of Cresta in the Afternoon. It was this week, 2 years ago, that then Pope Benedict XVI released his second book in what became a trilogy called Jesus of Nazareth. This one was Holy Week, From the Entrance into Jerusalem to the Resurrection. And, of course, that was the follow-up to Jesus of Nazareth, from the baptism in the Jordan to the Transfiguration. But as we begin this Holy Week, we thought it would be a great idea to remember that book and remember some of the discussion that we had surrounding it. It was Holy Week 2 years ago, in which we conducted a number of interviews on Pope Benedict's book on Holy Week. So today we're going to revisit some of those interviews and take us deeper into Holy Week. We're going to be talking with the theologian Father James Shaw. We'll talk to Father Robert Barron. We'll talk to Mark Brumley from Ignatius Press, who published this entire trilogy. We'll also talk to Tim Gray from the Augustine Institute. You know, Jesus of Nazareth is the Son of God. No myth, revolutionary, or misunderstood prophet, insists Benedict XVI. Indeed, Benedict maintains that the evidence, fairly considered, brings us face to face with the challenge of Jesus, a real man who taught and acted in ways that were tantamount to claims of divine authority, claims not easily dismissed by lunacy or deception. That's the introduction to Jesus of Nazareth, Holy Week, From the Entrance into Jerusalem to the Resurrection. So we're going to look at these interviews that we did during Holy Week, analyzing this book and the theology that comes from it. So that's what's coming up here on Cresta in the Afternoon. But first, let's get a check of today's headlines. This is the news for Monday, March 25th, the Solemnity of the Ascent of the Annunciation. And today's news is brought to you in part by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Two laws that essentially ban same-sex marriage are about to land before the Supreme Court. Civil rights attorney Angela Gilampo says both cases could have a big impact at the state and federal level.
There are two separate cases going in front of the Supreme Court, one that only touches on the federal distinction and definition of marriage as between a man and a woman. The other case is the state case, the Prop 8 California case.
Giampolo says she hopes that the Supreme Court will strike down both laws, which she views as discriminatory. Peter Sprigg with the Family Research Council sees it differently. He says the High Court should uphold the definition of marriage as between one man and one woman.
States have the right to decide for themselves what their definition of marriage will be. I think it's legitimate for the federal government to recognize only one uniform standard, uniform definition of marriage for the whole nation.
Sprigg also says that overturning bans on same-sex so-called marriage would be an extreme move for the court.
The opposite extreme would be for the court to simply declare that there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage and essentially impose that on all 50 states.
Arguments in this case, both cases, will begin tomorrow. A U.S. District Court judge has dismissed a challenge to the HHS mandate brought by Franciscan University of Steubenville and the Michigan Catholic Conference. Judge Algernon Marbley, a Clinton appointee, compared Franciscan University's concerns about federal enforcement of the mandate to a, quote, phantom specter spawned by the plaintiff's own unsubstantiated fears, end quote. Judge Marbley added that federal action against the university and the Michigan Catholic Conference would be a bizarre and unforeseeable occurrence based on the administration's representations in court that it would not enforce the mandate against religious organizations. New York's Christian community is celebrating Holy Week. New York Archbishop Cardinal Timothy Dolan presided over a full house at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Midtown. Cardinal Dolan offered parishioners a comment on his time in Rome.
You know, I just got back from three historic weeks in Rome, and you better get used to hearing a lot of stories about those 3 weeks.
Pope Francis himself celebrated Palm Sunday at the Vatican a day after a historic meeting with Pope Emeritus Benedict. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers is casting doubt over the effectiveness of President Obama's trip to the Middle East.
The president squandered great opportunity to actually show leadership and push them in a place where they could either get an agreement on a meeting, they didn't get it, just got a speech, get to some agreement on what was going to move the path forward on Syria, didn't get that.
The Michigan Republican told CBS's Face the Nation that Obama was too vague about America's position on the violence in Syria. The president committed $200 million in humanitarian aid to help Jordan manage a flood of refugees fleeing violence in war-torn Syria. Cyprus has a $13 billion bank bailout deal with international lenders. The deal will result in the shutdown of the second largest bank in Cyprus. Deposits under 100,000 euros in that bank will be transferred to the Bank of Cyprus, and deposits higher than that will be frozen and used to help solve the country's debt. And President Obama will designate 5 new national monuments today. They are the First State National Monument in Delaware, Rio Grande del Norte National Monument in New Mexico, the San Juan Islands National Monument in Washington State, Charles Young Buffalo Soldiers National Monument in Ohio, and a monument commemorating Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad in Maryland. And now your fascinating fact for the day. There are 12,386,344 possible plays in every game of baseball. For Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Nick Tom.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Joining me right now, Father James Schall, professor of political philosophy at Georgetown University. He has written hundreds of essays on political, theological, literary, and philosophical issues, and is the author of numerous books, including The Life of the Mind, On the Joys and Travails of Thinking, and The Regensburg Lecture. He's joining us as we continue our look at Holy Week, from the entrance into Jerusalem to the resurrection, and through the eyes of Pope Benedict XVI in his second volume, Jesus of Nazareth. Father, good to have you back. Thank you.
Yes, it's nice talking to you, Al.
The Pope Benedict in this book is firmly rooted within, of course, the Catholic tradition. And yet he writes as though there's still something to be discovered, still something to be understood, still something new to be said about Jesus. This combination of tradition and novelty, I think, is incredible.
Yes, that's a good point. First of all, we have to realize that we're dealing with a major scholar. And so while it isn't overwhelming that he writes as a kind of an academic, this book is not, strictly speaking, that way, and yet suffused through the whole book, and you get this feeling that this man has read the documents, he's read the history, he's read the background of the thing, and he has thought about it all, and he has put it all together. And I think that one of the great things about this book is that it is not presented as a book which is a result of his scholarly work, but it's the personal reflections about a pope who says, I'm writing to tell you what this pope has understood who this man was.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, he is not kind of either saying something dogmatically, or he's not saying something, you might say scholarly, but he's saying something that he thinks is true. And yet at the same time, he shows you the foundations why he thinks that.
Yeah. I think so. In a way, he's trying to be a witness himself.
Exactly.
Yeah, to his own encounter with Jesus, and I think.
And not only that, he's a witness to himself, but his whole methodology is that what we are witnessing to is a live tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Not only a live tradition, but a live reality that has been given to us and handed down to us, and that it is the same. One of the things you get overwhelmed by is that the purpose of the hierarchy and the purpose of the church is not that they present something new, but that what was handed down at the beginning, that living witness is still present in the church in the same form, basically, that it was given in the beginning, and it's not the function of the church to say something different.
Right. One of the things, guys, I read the first volume when it came out, and I'm reading this volume, as we go through Holy Week, and I'm enjoying it immensely. But one thing that strikes me, and this might sound funny, but one thing that strikes me is that Pope Benedict really, I mean, he believes we know who Jesus was, that we have real knowledge of him in the scriptures.
Exactly. In fact, you know, he's there. It's a book that says Jesus is a real person, but that's the fact. And, you know, when I finished the first volume, one of the things that really struck me, and sounds like it pretty much struck you the same way, too, that what he is saying is that this man really did exist. That is to say, all these theories about Jesus Christ didn't exist, or he wasn't who he said he was, or he was a mere man and not a god, and he was only God and not a man. All these kind of theories that he was exactly what he said he was, and exactly what the church understood him to be from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and that and what he said he was the Son of God, that he was sent into the world to witness. To the truth and to witness to the world about the purpose of the Father in creating us and redeeming us, and so that the facts are that this man, whatever you want to think about him, whatever you want to deal about him, that he was what he said he was, and that your problem with dealing with him is not so much that you can argue that out of existence, but that you have to face the fact that either you accept it or you don't accept it. And if you don't accept it, you better have reasons to do so, because all the reasons that have been given throughout history to do so do not actually prove that he wasn't.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. This is a reality you just have to come to grips with one way or the other.
There's exactly. Exactly.
Now, talk to me about some of your favorite portions of the book.
Well, you know, one of the things about the book that I thought was enormously important was the coherence of all of the parts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, that sometimes you think, well, there's this Christ who was a baby, and then he was a boy, and then he was a young man, and then he got into this public life thing, and then he was in the world for a while, and he got picked up by the local gendarmes and was killed. Well, the thing about it was that this is one complete, coherent life of a single person who lived through these things. And so you get the impression that the parts all fit together, including the parts that are most poignant or most gripping, the death and resurrection and what that means. And I think that the Pope has a genius, really, for explaining why these things fit together properly. So if you might say it's not so much the parts, but it is how the parts of Christ's life or the episodes of Christ's life are episodes of a single person's life and a witness to a life which itself was a transcendent life. Mm-hmm. And so that the thing that strike you very much about this is the unity of it, the coherence of it. And so that you go away from thinking that this made sense. Another thing that struck me very much about the book is this, that the Pope is very, very clear that the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, was a Jew, and he was a man who was fulfilling the Old Testament law. And one of the things that strikes you about reading this book is the carefulness with which the Pope associates various incidents in the life of Christ in various names, various purposes, precisely with the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And he says all the way through constantly that the people who rejected him, the Jews who rejected him, very often the learned ones, the ones that should have recognized him, that the Pope takes special attention to show that, and they're not recognizing him, they did recognize, ironically enough, what the Old Testament says. So, for example, he brings up the question of the Magi, and he says that when the Magi first appeared and they asked around, they said, where is this man to be born? And they all the officials said, well, he's to be born in Bethlehem, and which is exactly where he was born. And yet, when he was born there, they didn't recognize him.
Yeah.
And again and again, that kind of a thing. In other words, that takes, for example, the question of the redemption by the cross. Why on earth would God ever do this kind of a terrible thing, kind of thing? And yet, at the same time, you go back and you read Isaiah and the prophets, there are certain quite clear lines in which this is precisely what is being worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you can read it, and you can read the same things and say, well, this doesn't have anything to do with Christ. And yet, and looking at it from, you might say, from the way that the Pope shows you, it is exactly what it is.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think this, what comes across is a coherent story, a narrative, something which is plausible as you read it through. It's credible. And you say, I've got to come to grips with this. Now, I have a question for you as a college professor, and I'm curious. We have these two volumes now, Jesus of Nazareth, and it's a wonderful combination of clear thinking, devotional thinking, scholarly awareness. And theological force. On the other side of the break, I'd like to know from you, from your experience in teaching college students, if you think undergraduates will read Volume 1 and Volume 2. Okay? I have to take a break. We'll come back, though, and I'll let you respond.
You're listening to a very special edition of Cresta in the Afternoon as we begin this Holy Week. It was 2 years ago this week that Pope Benedict XVI released his book on Holy Week. We look back at some of the interviews we did that whole
week. Now at the Ave Maria online store, Catholicism, an adult study program on DVD. This 10-hour, 5-DVD set is created and led by prominent theologian and sought-after speaker Father Robert Barron. Catholicism is filmed on location in high def with comprehensive catechesis appropriate for RCIA and other adult formation programs. And at the Ave Maria online store, it's 30% off the regular retail price. The biggest discount on Catholicism is only at AveMariaRadio.net.
Are you inspired by Christian family values, honesty, and integrity? These old-fashioned values are found where the most advanced designs and technologies are displayed. Hi, I'm Dan Hall from Pinckney Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram, and during our Ram Truck Month and Showcase event, you can express yourself in style and be treated with the dignity and respect you deserve. With over 6 acres of new and certified pre-owned vehicles, you can be assured of the lowest prices and highest quality. Visit us at danhallautomall.com.
This program is brought to you in part by CatholicMatch.com. Marriage and family life is the foundation of society. Catholic Match is doing its part to help build the culture of marriage by providing an online community that acts as a companion for singles as they grow in their faith while discerning God's will. CatholicMatch.com, faith-focused dating for today's single Catholics. More information available at CatholicMatch.com/Ave Maria.
Cresta in the Afternoon is brought to you in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, your national and local online business directory, connecting Christian business professionals with Catholic consumers. Advertisers have taken a stand to support Christian family values in the marketplace. It's important to support businesses that embrace life and promote the gospel of Christ. And at CatholicBusinessPages.com, business professionals have taken that stand. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
We're here with Bert Gezzi, author of Voices of the Saints. And today, we'll be talking about Blessed Henry Suso, whose feast day is January 25th. Bert?
Suso was a Dominican who lived in Constance, Switzerland, who had a very profound, life-changing encounter with God when he was 18 years old, and from that time became a mystic, one deeply immersed in prayer and union with God. But his union with God was mixed with a long period of depression and a kind of emotional illness that afflicted him, long periods of dryness and confusion, but didn't get dispelled until he was consulted another great mystic, Meister Eckhart, and that consultation with Eckhart and the counseling he received cleared up the problem, and from that time forward he was clear. He spent the later part of his life, sometime after 40, in Christian service, preaching, teaching, writing, and counseling people throughout the countryside. His book, which is called A Little Book of Eternal Wisdom, was the most popular spiritual book in Europe before Thomas a Kempis wrote The Imitation of Christ. And here's a prayer from that book. My soul has longed for you all night, O eternal wisdom, and in the early morning I turn to you from the depths of my heart. May your holy presence remove all dangers from my soul and body. May your many graces fill the inmost recesses of my heart and inflame it with your divine love. He underwent many false accusations for some reason. He wasn't a very popular person. He was accused of theft and of poisoning and heresy. All these accusations were cleared away. He was innocent of all the charges, but he had many opponents for some reason. His life message is that, you know, a person can still undergo dryness and confusion and even emotional problems and have God very, very close to him. We don't need to be afraid when we go through dryness or problems because God is there beside us.
If we have those periods of dryness, just keep on going forward in faith. And that's Blessed Henry Suso, brought to us today by Bert Gezzi, the author of Voices of the Saints.
You're listening to a very special edition of Cresta in the Afternoon as we begin this Holy Week. It was 2 years ago this week that Pope Benedict XVI released his book on Holy Week. We look back at some of the interviews we did that Holy Week.
And a good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. My guest is Father James Schall. We are looking at Jesus of Nazareth, the second volume in Pope Benedict's, at this point, two-volume work. There may be a third volume dealing with the infancy narratives. I don't know if that will come about or not, but I hope so. And Father Schall has written, early in the 21st century, Anno Domini, the Pope of Rome writes a two-volume scholarly, straightforward book in which he reaffirms that what the Church taught in the beginning was then true, and the same understanding of Jesus is still true. None of the massive efforts that have sought to disprove these truths about Jesus have succeeded. They can be understood in their logic and in their scholarship. It is part of Catholicism to know its enemies and to deal with them honorably. But it is also of the essence of Catholicism to insist that the facts are there. In the Passion, Crucifixion, Death, Resurrection, and Ascension of Christ, we have a unified narration that is consistent both with the fact that Christ was true man who suffered, died, and was buried, and with the fact that he rose again and ascended into heaven. I asked you before the break, Father, if we both admire these books. I'm wondering if you know college students. And so I want you to know, do you think undergraduates today would read these books?
My judgment would be that in both cases they would need to be recommended and read together.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have a class this semester, and it's a special class. It's about 60 students, and we've read two of the papal books. We read John Paul's Memory and Identity.
Yes.
And we read Colonel Ratzinger's book called Eschatology, Death,
yeah.
and Eternal Life. Mm-hmm. And both of those books are, they recognize, are powerful, powerful books.
Yeah.
And that they recognize that, first of all, the men who write them are inspiring, but secondly, the men who write them know what they're talking about, and that they're themselves genuine thinkers. And so once they read the thing, and once they recognize the intelligence included in this thing, I think there isn't much problem at all. The problem is sitting down and reading it.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody would have very much difficulty in these two books agreeing. I mean, it reads like a biography, really, and it reads like a good biography, and suspensing and suspenseful, and at the same time convincing. And so I think the question is simply saying, look, this is worth reading, and go and do it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that one book of mine, another sort of learning, and I found over the years that if you recommend to students that they should read this, and you give them either an occasion or an opportunity or something like that to do so, they'll do so. And so that very often, what is a student? A student is somebody who doesn't know very much yet, and he's curious, and he's just kind of becoming alert. And he can be open to anything. He's open to good things, bad things, indifferent things, crazy things, And very often what he needs to find is some book or some guidance that says, look, take a look at this, read this. And very often that's what's lacking. They're going to be assigned a million other things to do, a million other books and a hundred other things to do. And everybody will look upon this as, that's a theology book, or that's something that has to do with Catholics or something like that. But And not so much that it's a book that's well worth reading, simply to be informed and simply to be learned about what these facts are about. And so I think that my own belief is that, people ask me this, are students smarter than that now than they were 30 years ago? The answer is no. You could say the same as 50 years ago, that a young student at 21 years old or 18 years old is the same thing. He's smart, he's not smart, he's relatively smart, he's crazy smart, whatever he is. But he's somebody who is just learning these things. And that therefore the question is, what inspires him? What gets him going? And so I think that the answer to that question is what is presented to him to think about and to read, and is it in a coherent order? And so St. Thomas, for example, says very often you get confused about this thing because you're given one thing from one side, one thing from another side, one thing from another side, and nothing ever is kind of...
You're listening to a very special edition of Cresta in the Afternoon as we begin this Holy Week. It was 2 years ago this week that Pope Benedict XVI released his book on Holy Week. We look back at some of the interviews we did that Holy Week.
About the scope of the thing, because the scope of the thing is really not just history, or not just theology, or not just scripture, but the scope of the thing, like the number of times, for example, he quotes Plato in there, is quite impressive. Indeed, I did that in class the other day. We're doing Plato, and there's a famous section in Book 2 of the Republic where Glaucon is talking about what would happen if a good man appeared in any existing society.
Mm-hmm.
And he's asking the question, well, what's the opinion of most people? And the answer was, well, they'd put him in jail, they'd beat him, they'd put his eyes out and eventually crucify him. Well, now that's written, Plato dies in 347. So that's written some 400 years before before Christ. And so when you read it with the illumination of Christ, and this was Pope City, he referred to this very passage. He says when you see that these things have overtones to them which are incredible, And yet here you're reading a Greek who's saying this thing, this is what would happen to it. And now you read in the Pope's book and saying, this is indeed what did happen. The just man, when the just man did appear in this society, and what happened? They didn't recognize him, and they killed him.
Yep.
So I've always been, both Benedict and John Paul II referred to the relationship between the death of Socrates and the death of Christ, and that's a theme I'm always working on, that what happened in both cases was that a civil society, usually a good civil society, or the most decent one of its time, when they killed the best man. And they killed the best man thinking that it was a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore you've got this irony of what happens when a good man occurs. He doesn't always recognize. In fact, very often he's not recognized. So one of the themes that goes through the Old Testament constantly is, why were the prophets not recognized? Why were the prophets not recognized? Mm-hmm. And so that comes to a head, of course, in the Passion story.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's very good. Setup. I mean, there's the irony here is that in both Socrates' case and Jesus' case, they are killed because those in leadership think that the civil society will be better off with them dead.
Exactly. Yeah. Better that one man dies than that's a whole society perishes, he says. And so, this is why it's very interesting to compare Socrates and Christ. I mean, Socrates is not Christ. He's a philosopher. He's a very powerful character. And the difference, of course, is that Christ is the Son of God, and that Christ is coming into the world in a certain sense, having been prepared from the very foundations of the world that this event occurs. And very often when you see it in the Christ says, my time has now come, let us go hence, and this kind of thing. So that you have this awareness that this vast preparation has been coming about, and yet this vast preparation coming about is the incredible thing that you mean to say that God used this way to redeem the human race, and the answer is, well, yes, he did. This is the way that was chosen. Well, why? Well, of course, you got some background of the whole thing is because Christ is not coming into the world to force us to believe or anything like that. He's coming into the world to be an example, and not only to example, but to suffer and die for us. And in doing that, he is leaving us free to accept him or not to accept him. Each of us down the ages as we follow this account. And so that every life in some sense has to come to terms with what in effect Christ was standing for. Do you or do you not stand for what in effect is good? So that the Socratic principle, which I call a civilizational principle, it is never right to do wrong, is basically what Christ stood for. It is never right to do wrong. And so that in Socrates' case, you say, well, now, he could have gone free if he had just done something he thought was dishonorable. Well, he wouldn't do that. And so if he had have done that, he had have said, or if Christ would have said, come down from the cross, so he came down from the cross to show him how strong he was. If he had have done that, he would precisely have failed to do that which was essential to do, mm-hmm. namely to do what is right at all times as an example.
Yeah.
And therefore that we ourselves are being taught all the time that this is the fundamental principle of our existence, namely that it is never right to do wrong.
Yeah. Well, again, there's, as you point out, the coming of Christ was prepared for a long time. In the mind of God, the Jesus of Nazareth, Volume 1 and Volume 2, lays out the inner logic of this, again, rendering it incredibly plausible and credible. And, Father, once again, thanks for being with me. Always good talking with you. Father James Schall is Professor of Political Philosophy at Georgetown University. I'm Al Cresta.
You're listening to a very special edition of Cresta in the Afternoon as we begin this Holy Week. It was 2 years ago this week that Pope Benedict XVI released his book on Holy Week. We look back at some of the interviews we did that whole week.
You're following Jesus' path from Nazareth to Galilee, where he delivered the Sermon on the Mount. Visit Israel and see the sites where Jesus spread the word. The stories you've heard since childhood will come alive with new meaning. You'll never hear the Mass the same again. And you'll never forget a vacation in Israel. The welcoming people, ancient cities, and modern hotels. Every Catholic should see where the Gospels happened. Visit Israel. You'll never be the same. Learn more at bestdealsisrael.com.
Now, the greatest story ever told comes to the stage. The spectacular stage production, The Cross and the Life. Critics say it's amazing, the Broadway version of The Passion of Christ. See why audiences love it.
He's alive, he's alive.
March 24th through the 31st in Music Hall. Get tickets now at the Music Hall box office.
Good day, I'm Al Cresta. One of the most important lessons Pope Benedict taught us during his highly significant papacy was that the Church of Jesus Christ is ours. We, the laity, we're responsible for its well-being and its future. Not just bishops, priests, or religious. Rather, it's us, the laity, the folks in the pews. We have co-responsibility for the Church with the priests and the bishops. We're not just collaborators, we are co-responsible. We're to build the Church and bless the nation. Now, to do that, we need our voice to be heard. So during the week of April 8th through the 12th, Ave Maria Radio will conduct its annual Spring Pledge Drive. The money we raise will be critical for our financial future. You know the drill. We need your help, we need your partnership, and we need it now. Tune in on the Internet at AveMariaRadio.net and pledge your support, or call 877-288-1077, a number you know well. That's April 8th through 12th. Keep listening and support Ave Maria Radio. We'll build the Church and bless the nation.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
We're now in Holy Week, the great days of the Church's year, the high holy days, none are higher. Easter is much bigger than Christmas. I'm asking you to share the sufferings of Christ more deeply so you can share his resurrection more fully. You know today's story well. The events are familiar, but prayer and penance are necessary to understand the meaning of Judas's betrayal and Mary Magdalene's love and Jesus's terror. Darkness dreads light. Sin hates grace. Hardness of heart blocks mercy. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany. They made him supper. Martha served and Lazarus was there. Mary took a pound of costly ointment and anointed Jesus' feet and wiped them with her hair, and the whole house was filled with fragrance. Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, the betrayer, said, "Why wasn't the ointment sold and the money given to the poor?" Jesus said, "Leave her alone. Let her keep it for the day of my burial. The poor you have always with you, but you do not always have me." God has a special love for generous souls like Martha and Mary, who keep nothing back. God seeks bold and generous hearts like those of Peter and Paul, who keep nothing back. Now do you understand what Mary did? She kept nothing back. Are you keeping anything back? How are you anointing the feet of Jesus? What do you do to comfort the poor or help the sick and the starving, the neglected and unloved? I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read today at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you too can be more fully alive.
You're listening to a very special edition of Cresta in the Afternoon as we begin this Holy Week. It was 2 years ago this week that Pope Benedict XVI released his book on Holy Week. We look back at some of the interviews we did that Holy Week.
And good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. As we approach the Solemn Triduum, we are continuing to look at the saving events of Holy Week, as seen in Pope Benedict XVI's book, Jesus of Nazareth, Holy Week from the Entrance into Jerusalem to the Resurrection. And with me right now, Father Robert Barron. He was ordained a priest from the Archdiocese of Chicago in 1986. He is the creator of Word on Fire Ministries, teaches systematic theology at the University of St. Mary at the Lake Mundelein Seminary, and is host of the forthcoming landmark film series entitled The Catholicism Project. He's the author of many books, and it's a great pleasure, Father, to have you back with me again. Thanks.
Al, thank you. Always good to be on with you.
The Pope Benedict's book, Jesus of Nazareth, Holy Week, I am impressed with it as much as I was with Volume 1, and I've been reading it for my own personal edification through the week, and also talking with many people about it. This may sound funny. I mentioned this to Father Schall earlier today. One thing you come away with reading this, and I think anybody who read this would come away thinking this, you come away from this saying, he really believes that story.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I
mean, yeah.
The details are dealt with seriously.
Mm-hmm.
The coherence of the narrative is dealt with seriously. He's immersed in the tradition. He is also capable of mining new insights. And I'm impressed with it.
It's an extraordinary book. You're right, and it's a follow up to that also extraordinary first volume.
Yeah.
And I think you're right in putting your finger on something that we've gone through several stages in biblical interpretation. The historical critical method was so dominant. When I was coming of age, that's what we did with the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
go back to the intention of the human author. You try to understand the social setting, et cetera, et cetera. We did a lot of what they called Formgeschichte in the German, criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea there was that, you kind of look at the layers of the text and you say a lot of what we read now is later community inventions, et cetera, et cetera. And it distorted things because it was so one-sided. There were good things in that method. I'm not repudiating it. But it was so one-sided that we just got this instinct of looking at the Bible and saying, well, none of that actually happened.
Right.
It's just, kind of later spiritual meditations, or it's the community arguing with itself.
Yeah, you always held it a little bit at arm's length, saying to yourself, I'm not sure if I should really enter into this story as true.
That's right. And I think now, scholars have kind of moved through that. A lot of them have anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And they've begun to say, look at the beginning of Luke's gospel. Luke lays out for us there what an ancient historian would have said. Like, I've listened to people, I've compiled eyewitness accounts, and I want to give you, as best I can, an account of what happened.
Yeah.
That he's not an historian in our sense. That's true, and there are significant differences there. Nevertheless, they were very interested in what really happened. If you said, well, this is kind of a spiritual meditation, they'd say, what? I mean, they were very interested in conveying to us. Now, yes, in a theologically stylized way, that's true, in a way that brings out the theological significance, but they were massively interested in telling us what happened.
Yeah.
And you see, the thing is, I've told people this in homilies, mythical literature is like the Star Wars movie,
right.
In a galaxy far, far away, a long time ago. You say once upon a time, and that's good because what you're signaling there is I'm telling you some perennial truth about nature or about human existence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a myth.
Sure.
I love the myths, but the Bible is not a myth.
Right.
And one of the clues we get, things like in the Creed, where you say he was crucified under Pontius Pilate.
That's in the Creed, not in a galaxy
far, far away. That's saying this guy whom people knew, who was the grubby Roman procurator, that's when it, or like when Quirinius was governor of Syria and Augustus, they're naming very particular people, particular events. So I think that part, side of the gospel, Pope Benedict and other scholars today are recovering.
Yeah, I agree, and they were interested in good news, not just good views.
That's right.
And these were bearing witness to events that had occurred among them.
That's right. And it's got to be good. And it's got to be news. It's got to be evangel, you know, the gospel. And, yeah, I see, what I always say, there's an excitement that runs through every page of the New Testament, which is not like a mythic sort of wisdom intuition. You know what I mean? I love the myths, but they convey these sort of deep truths. You don't read a myth, though, with a sense of like, wow, that's exciting, that's new. I didn't expect that. But you do get that in the Gospels. They knew this Jesus.
You're listening to a very special edition of Cresta in the Afternoon as we begin this Holy Week. It was 2 years ago this week that Pope Benedict XVI released his book on Holy Week. We look back at some of the interviews we did that Holy Week.
Right through the New Testament, from Matthew to the book of Revelation, is that novelty. That's Easter. That's the gospel faith.
We had Palm Sunday on Sunday, and then Jesus is now in Jerusalem, and he's discoursing on the kingdom. Talk to us about what did Jesus do during Holy Week before we knew it was Holy Week and before we hit Holy Thursday.
Well, we hear that he's teaching in the temple precincts, which is an important thing. You know, he's come to Jerusalem as a Davidic warrior. That's part of it. He enters as Zechariah said he would, on the foal of an ass. And so Jesus knew he was entering as a Davidic king. He comes into the temple precincts and causes this ruckus, you know. And that, too, was a prophetic act. It was a kind of picking of a fight, if you want. It was a challenge to the temple establishment and his announcement, prophetic announcement, he was going to establish a new temple, the temple of his body. So he was doing these sort of provocative acts in the Davidic tradition. He was coming in as the Mashiach, the anointed son of David.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all of that was a very important preparation, because what we see in Holy Week, in Holy Thursday, Good Friday, is this engagement of the struggle. What he signals at the Last Supper, this is my body, this is my blood, will be given for you. He's signaling this great act of sacrifice, which then takes place on Good Friday. He's also operating there in a temple setting, and Pope Benedict now is so good at that, isn't he, at showing that the Old Testament temple overtones of what Jesus is doing, that he is performing this ultimate consummating sacrifice that sums up all the sacrifices of the temple. So he's a priest. He's a warrior, a king, if you want. He's also a priest. He's a prophet because he performs his great prophetic act in the temple. So he's summing up there his messianic identity, priest, prophet, and king.
He is, you mentioned the Old Testament background here. In the high priestly prayer in the Gospel of John, Benedict puts it against the backdrop of the Day of Atonement. And I hadn't seen that before, and I thought, it's amazing to me that there's still so much for me to learn from these passages.
I think people are rediscovering now, it's almost like a post-historical critical thing, they're rediscovering how deeply Jewish and deeply Old Testament these New Testament texts are. How often we hear, you know, kata ta grapha, according to the Scriptures. Well, that's how they read Jesus. I mean, that was their frame of reference, was what we call the Old Testament, the grapha, the writings, the Scriptures. And so everything was read against that background. Now you have the letter to the Hebrews, for example, which does all of that with Jesus' high priestly sacrifice. And, right, it's filled with the language of, we call today Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the one day when the high priest would enter the Holy of Holies. He'd perform this great sacrifice on his own behalf and on behalf of all of Israel, the scapegoat. They placed the sins of the nation upon the scapegoat. They sacrificed another animal. He brought the blood out and sprinkled it on the people. All of it was a great act of reconnection, I would say, the sacrificial act by which the sins of the people are forgiven and God and the people are reconnected. The author of the letter to the Hebrews saw all of that happening in the cross. Jesus is the scapegoat. The sins of Israel, the sins of the world are placed upon him. He's sacrificed, this great act of atonement, reparation for sin. And then how beautiful, as the blood and water come from his side, it's like the high priest sprinkling the people with the blood.
Yes.
It's Yahweh giving his lifeblood for the people. And then, of course, that beautiful thing that the Gospels emphasize, the curtain in the temple torn in two. Well, see, what is that? But that's the high priest now entering through that curtain into the Holy of Holies.
Mm-hmm.
Or, if you want, the high priest coming out. The temple is torn, or the curtain is torn, so he comes out now to meet the people. All of that imagery is Yom Kippur, a Day of Atonement imagery, and it's happening on the cross. So that's the Old Testament setting for a Good Friday.
Now, let me take you back to Holy Thursday, and I'll make what might be a provocative statement, but you'll put it in proper context. Without Holy Thursday, we wouldn't really know what the meaning of Good Friday was, that Jesus' death would be one more painful crucifixion among thousands that occurred in Rome. And we wouldn't know, it would not have the meaning that it does today without Holy Thursday.
Quite right. Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. Is he's telling his disciples in advance, here's what my death means. It's not just, as you say, one poor guy ground under by the wheel of history. It's this act of sacrifice. This is my body, this is my blood, the body that will be given for you, the blood that will be shed for you. Well, see, all that was evocative for a first century Jew of this act of bringing the lamb to the temple, its throat being cut, and then the blood caught by the priest, who would then offer it on the altar. Well, see, as he passes the cup of wine around, saying, this is the cup of my blood,
mm-hmm.
Well, they all knew what that meant. That meant, we are the priests who are catching the blood of sacrifice, which is now going to be offered on the altar of the cross. I mean, that's what he was doing. He was correlating what they knew about the temple to what he was going to do the next day.
Yeah.
And the church preserves that at every Mass. That's the power of that. And for me as a priest, I'm a priest, not just a minister, not just a preacher. I'm a priest.
That's right.
Because I'm participating in this sacrificial act of the Lord. And every time I hold that chalice in my hands and I say the words of Christ, it's incredibly powerful because it links me to him, but also to that whole tradition of temple priesthood. It's the great act of atonement, reparation, sacrifice. The Mass is the Holy of Holies. Every Mass is the Day of Atonement for us, you know?
Yes.
So all of that, you're right, is the way Holy Thursday interprets Good Friday.
Yeah.
And then it's summed up in the Mass.
You know, for many years, the image of the synagogue seemed to dominate in the way that we interpreted first century Palestinian Judaism.
Yes.
You know, where its devotional enthusiasms lied. But it seems to me we're ready for a new temple theology.
Yes, and everyone's doing it. Read Brand Petrie's book on the Jewish roots of the Eucharist. Everyone's doing that now, and it's a very powerful moment.
Father, thanks once again. Always good talking to you. How do people stay in touch with you?
Wordonfire.org. Take a look there, and you'll see all sorts of things.
Very good. Wordonfire.org. Father Robert Barron, I'm Al Cresta.
You're listening to a very special edition of Cresta in the Afternoon as we begin this Holy Week. It was 2 years ago this week that Pope Benedict XVI released his book on Holy Week. We look back at some of the interviews we did that Holy Week.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible by our day sponsor, To Honor the Servants of God's Love, a religious order based in Ann Arbor. On this, the feast day of the Annunciation, may the Lord bring his abundant blessings upon these holy women.
You can be a day sponsor too. Just pick up the phone and call toll free 1-877-288-1077 and say, I want to be a day sponsor.
You've been visiting Jerusalem in your mind as long as you've been hearing Mass. But now you're in the Garden of Gethsemane where Jesus stood. Visit Israel and walk the same cobbled streets he walked to the site of the crucifixion. You'll never celebrate the Passion the same again. And you'll never forget a vacation in Israel. The welcoming people, ancient cities, and modern hotels. Every Catholic should see where the Gospels happened. Visit Israel. You'll never be the same. Learn more at bestdealsisrael.com.
Officials turn attention to low birth rates in South Korea.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette
who is proudly pro-life.
Fewer babies being born in developing countries mean a growing elderly population. It seems South Korean officials are targeting abortion as a primary culprit of this alarming trend. Even though abortion there is mostly illegal, authorities have long turned a blind eye to it. As a result, abortions are common and fairly cheap. To remedy this, the government is trying to broadcast a more pro-life message with public service announcements such as, "With abortion, you are aborting the future." Perhaps a better solution would be to enforce already existing laws.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelter, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Nick Tom, hosting this very special edition of Cresta in the Afternoon. It was this week, 2 years ago, that then Pope Benedict XVI released the second in what became a trilogy on Jesus of Nazareth. The first was from the baptism in the Jordan to the Transfiguration. And as I said, 2 years ago this week, he released the second in that trilogy, Holy Week, from the entrance into Jerusalem to the resurrection. And, of course, he went on to write the third one as well. But because of this anniversary and because we are entering Holy Week today, we decided to go back and listen to some of the interviews that we played, that we interviewed on 2 weeks, 2 years ago this week. We talked to, in his last hour, Father James Shaw, the famous theologian, Father Robert Barron of Word on Fire. Is also the rector now at Mundelein Seminary in Chicago. And coming up next hour, we're going to talk to Mark Brumley from Ignatius Press, who published this whole trilogy, and also Tim Gray from the Augustine Institute. So, again, the book is Jesus of Nazareth, Holy Week, from the entrance into Jerusalem to the resurrection. We're going to continue next hour, again, focusing on this beginning of Holy Week and focusing on Benedict's writing in Holy Week, from the entrance into Jerusalem to the resurrection. We'll be back.
Would you like a copy of this program? If you miss a part of this program or want to hear it again, Ave Maria programming can be made yours when you order. Just call 734-930-4506. Within a few weeks, you'll receive a copy of this show and any others you want to order on CD. Call 734-930-4506.
Myler & Zipka Certified Public Accountants is proud to support Ave Maria Radio Programming. Myler & Zipka offer great services to WDEO listeners in Metro Detroit for all of your accounting and tax needs. Call Ken Zipka and let him know you appreciate him helping to keep Catholic radio alive in this area. Ken can be reached at 734-930-5500. That's 734-930-5500. Or on the web at mspccpa.com.
And now a word of encouragement from Mark Shea at CatholicExchange.com.
Many adults seek to avoid their own adulthood by engaging in a series of shallow relationships and forcing their children to be their best friends and peers as they muddle along through their various divorces, self-help groups, psychobabble fasts, and spiritual ephemera. It is the dubious achievement of our culture that it is faced for the first time in history with the widespread acceptance of men in their 40s and 50s who are living out the Peter Pan syndrome of perpetual boyhood and adolescence and who are still unwilling to be fathers to the children they have sired. Paul's counsel is succinct. Do not embitter your children. Grown-ups, and particularly fathers, do not help their children retain their sanity and joy for life by abandoning their parental responsibilities so dad can have a hot car and a girlfriend to get him through a prolonged adolescence disguised as a midlife crisis. Attention, men in midlife crisis. Grow up and